Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, brought to you by SaneBox. Get control of your email inbox. SaneBox is the way to go. SaneBox.com/martini for your no-obligation two-week trial. Plus, if you sign up through us, $25 in additional credit. That's SaneBox.com/martini. Jim Garrity of National Review is here. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, for the past 2 days, we have pilloried Hillary Clinton for lying. Lying about emails, lying about weapons transfers from Libya to Syrian rebels, including ISIS. We had Ron Fornier on yesterday talking about how her staff doesn't even care. Trust doesn't matter anymore. We finally got some honesty from Hillary Clinton. It was unintentional, I'll point out, but we got it yesterday. I believe she was in Nebraska because Warren Buffett was sitting directly behind her, and Hillary Clinton was slamming Donald Trump's tax cut plan while extolling her tax plan in the opposite direction. We're fairly sure this isn't what she meant to say, but she said it, and the reaction of the crowd is perhaps the most disturbing thing. But here's Hillary Clinton on Wednesday.
Trump wants to cut taxes for the super rich. Well, we're not going there, my friends. I'm telling you right now, we're going to write fairer rules for the middle class, and we aren't going to raise taxes on the middle class.
Yay, middle class tax hikes. Woo! Warren Buffett's behind her, clapping heartily. At no point behind her or on her own face do you see any sort of flicker of recognition of, did she just say tax hikes on the middle class? So, Jim, a lot of people are calling this a Freudian slip, and that's possibly true. I remember Bill Clinton in 1992 promising middle class tax cuts and then, of course, jacking them up on everybody. But the fact that this is the reaction in a liberal audience either means they're not paying attention or they're really okay with this if Hillary were to actually go in that direction.
What this comes down to is that when people say middle class tax hikes to an audience like that of diehard Democratic supporters, what everyone hears is middle class, but not like you. I meant the other middle class. You're the good middle class. It's those rotten, greedy, selfish middle class. The neighbors you can't stand, you know, who borrowed your lawnmower and didn't return it, they're the ones, you know. Somebody once said for a long time this country, you know, this was not a country in which you saw a lot of European-style class envy politics would flourish in this country. And somebody said it was because, one, American middle class, you know, used to define, was it Spiro Agnew who said take the average middle class family making $200,000 a year? Like, there was some point where he said his description of the middle class was what most people would have considered to be, you know, pretty darn wealthy. And then at some point you could be making 30 grand a year and people still thought of themselves as being middle class. Now, obviously these numbers shift a bit with inflation, but the gist being is that you could be very low middle class and still think of yourselves as being middle class. And you could be doing quite well for yourself and still think of yourself as middle class. And what somebody says is that the argument is that compared to Europe and compared to other countries where you've seen an aristocracy and you've seen the same people on top for generations, in America, people do not think of themselves as poor. They saw themselves as imminent millionaires,
yes,
or millionaires in the making, that their day was going to come, their ship was going to come in, that either going to get a better job or a better opportunity, or the investment was going to pay off, or they're building something, they'd sell their house at some point, and then eventually they would be wealthy too. The fact that there's this, you know, Hillary can offer a line that says, we'll punish that middle class, we'll fight, you know, all those darn undertaxed bastards in the middle class. You know, the fact that everybody applauds that says a lot about how that audience sees themselves. And one, they don't see themselves as part of the middle class anymore. And the second thing is they see the middle class as somebody who needs to be punished, somebody who's getting away with something. So the exact same, you know, darn those millionaires and billionaires rhetoric gets applied to people who are, quote unquote, middle class as well. And what it really comes down to is, you know how you define the wealthy in a lot of Americans' eyes these days, Greg?
How's that? Richer than me?
Making a dollar more than you are. This is poor logic and poor ideas for policy, you know, playing on people's envy here. But it seems to work for Hillary. The good news is that, you know, the Trump campaign and Republicans now have a very quick, easy soundbite of her pledging to support tax increases on the middle class and the audience applauding, meaning this is not some, oh, you didn't mean that, Hillary, type moment.
Yeah, I looked on Hillary's Twitter feed and there was no correction on the Twitter feed. I don't know if it came out in some other form. But even if Hillary and her supporters come out in reaction to this and say, well, you know what she meant. She meant tax hikes on the rich and corporations and that sort of thing. And that's a really horrible plan, too, because her job program is just huge government spending, not empowering businesses, whether small businesses, which would be in the rich people tax category with the way that the tax system works, or corporations, which already pay the highest rate in the industrialized world. Her solution is a big government-run jobs program. And in a recent interview, she said that it's going to be bigger than the Obama stimulus because he didn't get to do everything he wanted to do. So good luck, America.
It's stimulus that everybody found very disappointing, but bigger.
Yes, bigger and more disappointing.
Our politics are in reruns.
On to the bad martini now, and here's a story that the liberals are absolutely loving. We're doing this story with the help of Jazz Shaw over at Hot Air, who compiled some data courtesy of NOLA.com as well as Twitchy. On Wednesday, President Obama commuted the sentences of 214 federal inmates in a single day, mostly for nonviolent offenders, or as CNN described it, for drug offenders. It's a red-letter day for criminal justice reform because that's the most commutations issued in a single day since at least 1900. But Twitchy gets to the bottom of this. They say, take a moment to dry your eyes and note that almost all the prisoners whose sentences were commuted were jailed for nonviolent drug crimes. Of course, a handful were found guilty of using or carrying a firearm during a drug trafficking crime, possession of stolen firearm, or being a felon in possession of a firearm. What's a handful? A quick review of the list of Wednesday's commutations shows more than 50 prisoners convicted of firearms violations. But isn't that society's fault for flooding communities with so many guns? And so, Jim, the administration, once again, a little bit, more than a little bit inconsistent here, glossing over the gun crimes being committed here while also pushing for more gun laws.
You know, there is a school of thought amongst some gun rights advocates and Second Amendment advocates that contends that everything, you know, besides the usual lies, you could say, of gun control advocates, deep down, if you really, you know, pumped them full of truth serum, if you got them really drunk, they would come out and say that it's not really even about gun crimes, and it really isn't even about gun ownership per se, because they never give, you know, Rosie O'Donnell that much grief about her armed security or something like that. That deep down, it's just about culture. I don't like those people, right? They're rural. They're bumpkins. They cling to their guns and religion. That ultimately, this is all about tribal identity and snobbery and needing to define special groups and good groups and bad groups and a need to have somebody they can villainize. And they've chosen America's gun owners for this. And when you see something like this where the administration is saying, we need more gun laws, and then they turn around and give a pardon to people who violated gun laws, it adds credence to this theory that deep down, they don't even really care about that much. They see, you know, the argument you hear from my friend Cam Edwards, other folks at NRA News, is like, look, there's a bunch of really ridiculous deals that are given to violent offenders. It's not every prosecutor, it's not every court system, but he finds at least one he calls a deal of the day, which somebody who's got some sort of violent offense, usually armed robbery, usually mugging, usually something like that, carjacking sometimes, gets either suspended sentence, time served, probation, very little time in jail. It seems like a really light sentence for what is a violent crime that probably didn't kill somebody, but could have killed somebody. That certainly seems like an inherent dangerous gun-related crime. When you see this, coupled with the endless reaction, we need to pass more laws, you begin to conclude that this isn't, they don't really care that much about enforcing the laws. They just didn't care about passing the laws, and that at some point in the future, they will get serious about enforcing the laws when it gets the nice gun owner down the street who isn't a mugger, and they can use the law against him rather than the actual violent offender that most Americans would say needs to be dealt with and needs to be put behind bars for a significant period of time.
Yeah, there's a couple aspects of this that bother me. I've been talking to some experts about criminal justice reform has been in the news, and they say a lot of times people go to jail for simply drug crimes because even though they had a gun at the time, that got dropped by prosecutors in exchange for skipping the trial. You make a plea bargain, you send them off to prison for the drug crime. At the same time, I'm having a hard time figuring out what criminal justice reform means in the minds of a lot of people other than not punishing people as much for crime.
Yeah, you know, as somebody who's been sympathetic to these efforts, I think that is a fair criticism. I also was kind of surprised, I think it was a couple of years ago, that Rolling Stone, of all places, which is not exactly shy about its views on marijuana legalization, went back and found out that very, very, very few people are in jail for possession of marijuana. So this idea that these innocent teenagers and folks who are really not doing any crime to anybody else generally are not. Now, that may have been one of the charges at them at one point, but ultimately it's the other crimes they are committing in that process. So this idea, this argument that very much has been fueling this criminal justice reform effort, the idea that a lot of Americans who aren't really malevolent, who aren't really violent, who aren't really a menace to their the rest of the community are being thrown into jail and set on career paths with the, on paths of further criminality by this process. And I think that's a fair objection, that really if you see people being let go, the effort to kind of have more you know, logic in sentencing or more leniency, you know, every time you have a Willie Horton type situation where somebody gets let out and they commit another crime, people are going to feel that inclination to say, no, I want to lock them up and throw away the keys. So it's a fair point to be made here. I don't think a presidential pardon like this really helps restore people's faith in the system.
Yeah, a lot of confusion about what the facts are in this story. But where you're not going to find confusion is in your inbox, if in fact you subscribe to SaneBox, because as we've been describing all week, SaneBox gets the clutter out of your email system. You've got all those emails. How many thousands of emails have you not even read, much less actually responded to? So you can't read them all. You don't want to delete them all because you might miss something. But get SaneBox because it sorts through your email, moves all the trivial stuff into different folders, so the only messages in your inbox are the ones you actually want to see and are urgent. Aside from removing all the junk, you can focus on messages that matter. We've talked about the black hole, where you can just drag the email from the people that drive you nuts, and you're never going to do business with them, so just drag it to there, and you'll never hear from them again, so that's pretty good. We need more organization in our email life. We've got the great deal for our listeners at SaneBox.com/martini. In addition to the two-week free trial, they'll throw in an extra $25 credit by signing up through the 3-Martini Lunch. You don't even have to enter your credit card information unless you decide to buy at the end of your free trial, so there's really nothing to lose. Check it out today and let us know if you love all these different features. Getting your inbox manageable is something I'm still working on, but it's getting much better as a result of SaneBox. SaneBox.com/martini. And Jim, especially this year, you've mentioned in the past in your huge archive of 200,000 plus messages, it was especially bad during the primary season when you got messages that, you know, the assistant to the county commissioner in such a county has endorsed Jeb Bush. You don't really need to respond to that, and you probably should delete it, but it's good that it's not popping up on your screen and clogging up men and distracting you from messages you do need.
Oh, absolutely. And Greg, your point, all those messages you forget to reply to. You know, the good news is, Greg, I never forget to reply to your emails, right?
Yes.
I never think in my head, yeah, those sounds like good topics for the show, and then don't actually send the reply. SaneBox is still working on the way to actually plug into your brain and remind you to send those emails, but at least it makes it easier to see the emails that you have not replied to that you may want to. So a great tool for kind of helping sort, organize, and get you feel a little more productive with your email. So it's wonderful to have them as a sponsor.
Again, that's SaneBox.com, SaneBox.com/martini, SaneBox.com/martini. And sanity is something the Republican National Committee could use. This is the story that had everybody frothing at the mouth on Wednesday, Jim. This is the Washington Post version of the story. Turmoil in the Republican Party escalated Wednesday as party leaders, strategists, and donors voiced increased alarm about the flailing state of Donald Trump's candidacy and fears that the Republican presidential nominee was damaging the party with an extraordinary week of self-inflicted mistakes, gratuitous attacks, and missed opportunities. RNC Chairman Reince Priebus was described as quote-unquote very frustrated with and deeply disturbed by Trump's behavior over the past week, having run out of excuses to make on the nominee's behalf to donors and other party leaders, according to multiple people familiar with the events. Meanwhile, Trump's top campaign advisors are struggling once again to instill discipline in their candidate, who has spent recent days lurching from one controversy to another while seemingly skipping chances to go on the offensive against his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton. There was word that there was going to be a possible intervention that appears to not be happening now. One of Trump's top defenders, Newt Gingrich, who spoke at the convention, of course, is also worried. He says the current race is which of these two is the more unacceptable, because right now neither of them is acceptable. Trump is helping her to win by proving he is more unacceptable than she is. And I guess the last straw for Reince Priebus was that Trump would not publicly endorse Paul Ryan and John McCain in their upcoming primaries. I'm not sure conservatives think that endorsing John McCain ought to be the last straw. But, Jim, this campaign's been going on now for almost 14 months. It's amazing now that just 2 weeks after the convention, it's finally dawned on Reince Priebus that Trump is undisciplined and off message if he has one in the first place.
It really is kind of striking that, I think it was some person who had said, look, you know, you can accuse Ted Cruz's father of killing JFK, and you can say John McCain isn't really a hero because he got captured, and you can go after Megan, you can go down after all these people, but the moment you fail to endorse Paul Ryan, that is the last straw, sir. And it really does, if it really is being fueled by Reince Priebus, it really does kind of give this sense that you just don't cross the Wisconsin Mafia. You know, Priebus, Ryan, Scott Walker, you know, you'll wake up and find a giant, you know, cheese wedge in your bed the next morning when you, you know, this, you know, murmurs, oh, we've got to get rid of him. Oh, he's going to take, where have you been for the last year, guys? You know, this is like, this is baffling that they would suddenly reach this point. Yeah, you know, Hillary's poll bump from the convention seems pretty big, pretty solid. There's been a really awful bunch of state polls that came out this morning, but look, it's not like Trump's numbers are phenomenally different from where they were, you know, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, 4 months ago. Pretty much as soon as the general election started, she roared ahead. And what has kept, you know, Trump ahead was, you know, you could argue he had a pretty good convention, but I think the FBI's conclusion about her emails was very damaging. And then following that, you had, you know, either an ISIS attack or somebody shooting cops every day for about a week. And it created this atmosphere of the country is, you know, spinning out of control and we can't stay on the status quo. Well, since the Democratic convention has ended, thankfully, there has not been another high-profile ISIS attack. And thankfully, there has not been anybody ambushing cops. But the result of that is I don't get, you know, it mitigates this sense of things are so bad, you got to roll the dice on Trump. And instead, he's picking his fights with Ryan. He's picking, you know, he keeps arguing with the Khan family and things like that. And he just seems to be incapable of having any impulse control and not fighting with his nominal with his allies and then focusing his fire on Hillary. And instead, he's arguing, he's bringing up Ted Cruz. He brought up the Megyn Kelly stuff again yesterday. He brought up the comments about the disabled reporter the other day. He feels a need to relitigate every primary fight, and he can't put it behind him. He just doesn't have that ability. But what's fascinating is that so many Republicans seem surprised by this. And it took until the first week of August what was obvious to a lot of us from the very beginning. Again, and the other thing is, I don't think there is, short of Trump deciding suddenly, I don't want to do this anymore, I don't think there's any way to replace him as the nominee. The time to do this was at the convention, or even better, during the primaries. But a lot of Republicans didn't want to do that. Now they're stunned to find out where they are. So that's what makes it the crazy martini of the day, is that they finally come to the conclusion long after it would do them any good and they have any ability to do anything about it.
The thing that I find fascinating here, Jim, is that here you got everybody seeing what a potential dumpster fire this is. This guy's out of control. He's insulting people. He's a disgrace to the party. Why aren't you endorsing people? Wouldn't it be better for some of these people if Trump didn't endorse them?
Oh, yeah. In fact, if anything, you know, one of the poll numbers out today is that Senator Ayotte up in New Hampshire is in really rough shape. But she's actually running a couple points ahead of Donald Trump. Now, he actually was saying he was beating her because he had seen numbers that had him ahead of her. He's still losing in the state. You don't get any points for finishing ahead of the senators, the Republican senators in your office. Mitt Romney can tell you that. There are a bunch of states in 2012 that he won that the Republican senators lost that were on paper red states and that they should have won, and they did not. You kind of add that up there, you know, Trump has the vindictiveness really gives a very twisted idea of what he defines as victory and what he finds vindicating. And you know, he said it wasn't reassuring to hear him say yesterday that if he doesn't win this whole thing has been a waste of time. In light of that, you must get better as a candidate and you must stop turning your fire on other Republicans. It's time to put that aside, and he just won't. And the other thing is, actually, I think you're seeing this grumbling because the poll, there's a relation between the grumbling and the poll numbers. As long as there was that nice little surge out of the convention, Republicans are like, all right, it's going to be okay, you know, we'll be able to keep them under control. The poll numbers get bad, and all of a sudden people remember their principles and realize how terrible this is.
Way to go, Republicans. Way to go. Jim?
Wow. You never thought we'd have to compare them to Nevada. Huh?
It's a dire time. You never know what you're going to have to do. Jim, we'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for listening to the 3 Martini Lunch today. Once again, brought to you by SaneBox. Go to SaneBox.com/martini for that 2-week trial plus $25 in credit. And join us again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.